The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. On this edition of our show, I visit with Jenny Schutte at Tidal Rock Farms about how they market their beef, pork, and lamb direct to consumers. Learn the opportunities and challenges of marketing and managing what has become for them a thriving business as they work to create the perfect steak and pork chop. That's our topic for this week's Farming the Countryside, brought to you by Pivot BioProven. It's time to rethink nitrogen, and Pivot BioProven replaces nitrogen fertilizer with microbes that adhere to the crop's root system and apply nitrogen each day. 2019 performance report data shows Pivot BioProven consistently outperforms synthetic nitrogen fertilizer year over year, providing corn growers improved yields and a more dependable nitrogen supply that isn't lost to the environment. To read the performance report, go to pivotbio.com. And for more information on Pivot BioProven, just text PROVEN to 31313. Jenny Schutte and Pilot Rock Farms have been raising and marketing their livestock for several years now. They've built a thriving business as they raise their own beef, pork, and lamb, and then bring those cuts direct to consumers. When the COVID crisis hit, many grocery stores saw a run on meat purchases, which led farmers and ranchers to begin exploring the opportunities of bypassing the traditional packer route and having those animals processed locally, then selling the meat to consumers. It could be a way to raise the value of the product on the farm and fill a need. However, such changes can take time, and there are challenges to overcome. Jenny and I discussed what has worked for them, how COVID has changed the way they do business, and what the future holds for their farm and others in animal agriculture.
I'm visiting with Jenny Schutte here, and Jenny, I'm going to have you talk a little bit about Pilot Rock Farms and where you're at in Tennessee. First of all, thanks for taking the time to visit with me. And second, just tell folks about where your farm's located and kind of the general lay of the land there where you farm in Tennessee.
Sure. Thanks for having me. We are in southern middle Tennessee in Fayetteville, Tennessee. We live and work on two different farms, which I totally don't recommend having livestock on two different farms. But we live on the northern end of the county, and the northern end of the county is extremely hilly and rocky. And that's how we got our name, actually. We're Pile of Rock Farms, and where we live is nothing but a pile of rock. And I joke that the only thing that can grow here are cedar trees and more rocks, like the rocks have babies, and there's just multiple new rocks every year, I swear. But we have our sheep and pigs here, and then about 20 minutes south in the southern end of the county, which is very close to Huntsville, we have our cattle on some family ground where my husband grew up.
Yeah, I see you here on the map. I'm looking at you just north of Huntsville. Yes, yeah. Southern Tennessee here.
And that southern end of the county is much more row crops, much better ground, and can grow grass, unlike northern part of the county.
So you and your husband had a background in farming and agriculture anyway. You kind of did your own thing, it sounds like, after college, but eventually the two of you got married and then began this farm.
Yes. Yes, I grew up in southern Indiana on a dairy farm, and never thought I never wanted to live on a farm. Couldn't imagine milking cows every day, living a life like that. But here, and you're right, a roundabout way, I lived in Chicago and did advertising in New York and did marketing and came to Tennessee to do sales with Pfizer Animal Health at the time, and they're now Zoetis. But I was calling on a customer trying to get the vaccine business and found a husband instead, and have settled into I'm now a Yankee that's moved south and not going back, and started raising a family and realized that life on the road was not something I wanted to do in raising our children, and was traveling 9 states and said, I just can't do this anymore. So 4 or 5 years ago, we decided one night that I would quit that lifelong career and we would start. We were selling, we had some cattle and we were just selling some freezer beef, halves and wholes, but we really decided to jump into it about 5 years ago. And it really all started, I would go to all these fancy restaurants on Pfizer's dime, of course, and especially in Nashville, and would see these restaurants that would have local beef quoted on their menu, but that local beef was coming from Colorado or you know, Texas. And I just didn't understand, especially with such a big cow-calf state like we are, why weren't they getting something more local? And thought that would be a good business venture.
And it has been, it sounds like, but how does a person break into that? Because I would think there'd be some barriers to just jumping in and being able to sell steaks to some of those restaurants that you were going to.
You're absolutely right. So yes, originally it was like, what are we going to do? Just start selling wholesale retail cuts. Of course, you jump through the USDA hoops, make sure you get all your permits. And then I literally started pounding the streets and sending emails and calls, getting into restaurants and into chefs and sitting down with chefs and having that conversation, telling them what we do. But first, as a true salesman does, you go in there asking them what their needs are, what do they want out of a relationship like ours, because it's not, if they open it up with the first sentence being, I need the cheapest cuts I can get, then that's okay. There's plenty of restaurants out there that do that, but that's not our, they're not looking for a relationship with a local farmer. Not that we're the most expensive on the planet, but there is certainly a give and take to what the Ciscos of the world can provide versus what a local farmer can provide. So we, again, worked with the USDA, brought more cattle on board, and then we quickly wanted to add pork to our lineup. And that was, you know, I grew up on in Indiana. I joke that we just raise pigs, corn, and basketball players in Indiana. So all of us at one point in time have owned or worked on a hog farm. And I thought, oh, I know all this about pigs. Well, we wanted to raise pasture pigs. And there are no similarities between confinement pigs and pasture pigs. So I had a lot to learn. But it certainly has been fun with the pig side of things. And I know my husband enjoys it even more than I do, just because he really enjoys genetics. And you can turn a pig crop around a lot faster than you can one calf a year on a cow. And so it's been fun to play with the genetics side of the hog farming business.
You mentioned the genetics there. How do you make sure that you're getting then a quality product? Obviously, we all want to as farmers, but did you have to change your operation to ensure the quality of what you were getting out there to those restaurants and customers?
Well, yes. We knew what we'd been getting on the beef side just by doing the halves and wholes. I mean, we'd pick that product up for a customer and we'd be able to see what kind of marbling and eat some of the products, so we'd know the tenderness. But switching from a cow-calf operation to a calf-to-finish operation, I mean, finishing cattle is a lot different. Of course, a lot of cows in Tennessee, you see those calves are weaned on the truck to the sale barn. Not necessarily a lot of education around finishing animals. So that's something definitely we needed to learn and what we were going to feed them. But again, my husband on the genetic side, he's taken that bull by the horns, so to speak, and enjoys picking cattle specifically for marbling and tenderness and growth. But then on the pig side, you know, debating on what our base was going to be, and our base is a Berkshire, but we are bringing in, that's a meat for your listeners, that's a meat pig, that's a meat breed, and we wanted to bring fat back. We joke that we want to bring sexy back to fat, and that we don't want pork to be called the other white meat. We shoot for pork that is very deep red color, and you get that from the Berkshire breed. But then we're bringing on some of these quote lard pigs, and like a Meerschaum. Some people use a Mangalista. We do use a Meerschaum, and we're crossbreeding those because that's our goal. We're trying to create the perfect pork chop. And like I said, with pigs, it's easier to see what your pairings have done a lot quicker than a beef cow.
Is your customer mix right now mostly restaurants, direct to consumer, 50-50, or how has it panned out for you so far?
Well, when we very first started, like I said, I had this genius idea. Let's go to the chefs and the restaurants and grocery stores. Well, that was great, but we quickly realized we were running out of product just selling to the local consumer, moms and dads, because we would go to farmers markets, or we started to outfit our custom meat wagon. We were running. So why sell wholesale when you could sell retail? And we pulled out of all restaurants and grocery stores because we were able to sell at that retail price at a consumer level. So that was a no brainer. And we're selling by the cut. So it's all retail by the cut versus halves and wholes. We do not do quarters, halves, and wholes because we've outfitted, you know, we've got a walk-in freezer and we've got a, you know, four freezers in this custom trailer. We call it our famous meat wagon. And I can take that meat wagon anywhere as long as I've got a, you know, an owner's permission and then a city permit. I can set that thing up anywhere, kind of like a moving ice cream truck, but it's full of beef, pork, and lamb. So our customer base is, you know, the folks that want to buy weekly, not necessarily that want to fill their freezers for a year. You know, we'll send them to others in our area that are doing custom beef, pork, and lamb. But for us, it's those that want to buy weekly, maybe monthly with some monthly specials. And that's who we cater to.
So I know that COVID may have changed things, but did you have a regular schedule then of hitting certain towns on certain days with the meat wagon then?
Absolutely, yes. People, and we've posted on our website where we're going to be and when. And we're very heavy on social media with Facebook and Instagram, and we try to let folks know where we're going to be. But we have regular setups, especially during the farmers market season. People know where to find us. But then throughout the remainder of the year, like when farmers market season's closed down, we would take orders and deliver at certain locations. Like, you know, if I get a town that has a certain amount of orders, then I'll meet somewhere in that town and people come to me. I won't necessarily deliver to the house. They would come to me and meet up there and be able to sell that way and still have a good business throughout the winter months. But yes, that all changed when COVID hit.
Well, and I know when it did hit, you talk about how it changed because you started doing more personal deliveries. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. I remember vividly, it was a Wednesday night in March when President Trump came on and said, okay, this is going to be bad. Something's coming and we need to take precautions. And on Friday, that Friday, we always set up in our local town. And that Friday, we ran out of hamburger. And I always said, if we run out of hamburger, we're either going out of business or the world is coming to an end because cows come with a lot of hamburger. And so we're always sitting on hamburger. And that Friday, we had a line out the meat wagon. The rain was coming sideways, but people did not care. They were standing in line to buy up as much. And I didn't even think about putting limits on it. You know, just 2 weeks later, Walmart had limits on everything. Buy 1 pound of hamburger, one roll of toilet paper. And I didn't even think about that. So we were just, people were coming in and buying, you know, they normally would buy, you know, 1 pound of hamburger for the week. They came in wanting 20 to 30 pounds. And we were completely overwhelmed. Like, what is going on? And they got a little unruly. And so that very next week we said, okay, from now on, it's deliveries only. And so we would take online orders and I would deliver to people's doors. And it was great. We picked up so many new customers because of it, because that mom who just had a new baby, she didn't want to get out. Or, you know, someone had some kind of pre-existing condition and they didn't want to get out of their house. And they would leave a cooler on the front porch and I'd drop it in their cooler and send them a message that I just dropped it off, and they'd pay online and be on there, and I'd be on my way. We never saw each other, and that went on for a couple months.
Wow. Now, of course, it's someday we'll kind of get through this, but do you think it has changed your marketing forever? Do you think you'll continue to do the deliveries, or will you go back to what you used to, or what have you learned through all of this?
Well, that's a very good, it was an awakening to see how many people do appreciate the deliveries. When Tennessee opened back up, we stopped doing the deliveries, but then we had some customers say, can you still bring that to my house? Can you meet me at this certain location? And I've said it before, and I think I said it in that article, that Jeff Bezos has spoiled us all into thinking that we can have something delivered next day or in 2 days. And there's just that convenience of not having to go shop for your meat. Or shop for anything, especially even a Walmart pickup where you don't even have to see anyone, and it's all done online. And it's certainly a convenience for the busy parent who gets done at the end of the day, puts the kids to bed, and, well, I can't go to the grocery store now because I have who's going to watch the kids? And so they just place an order online, and it gets shipped to their door. And I think the consumer is wanting that with their produce, with their meat, of course, with their, you know, paper towels and toilet paper and everything else. And if they can do that, then that's a no-brainer for that consumer. And if I can, so I think what we as Pile Rock Farms are going to do right now, it's just my husband and I, it'd be, you know, who's going to take that delivery schedule if we really start that as a serious thing into the surrounding counties.
It, you mentioned about, you know, the demand there for a while. Has the demand remained strong? I suppose they aren't fighting over the hamburger the way they once were, but I would think that the demand is still very strong.
It is. It's insane. I mean, this time last year, I'd know exactly what I could go through in a month and what it would take to get us through to the next butcher date. But right now, it's because of all the new business. We've always said, if you try us, you'll never go back. And that's what's happened. So we have all this new business and they're not going back, even with the hamburger. And we're not able to supply the demand. I'm not able to get to that next butcher date, but we can have a whole conversation on butcher dates. I mean, that is certainly the hurdle. Even if someone gave me $1 million tomorrow to buy all the cattle I ever needed to finish, I can't get butcher dates. And so that has been the biggest hurdle that we've had so far. And we aren't the only ones. The whole country, I know, is in this predicament.
Right. No, we're hearing that in a lot of locations. And even though you're selling those cuts retail, I guess you did have a butcher shop somewhere that is cutting all that meat for you. You're not, you and your husband are not cutting the meat yourself.
That's right. That's right. Everybody says, why don't you get into the butcher business if that's the biggest hurdle? And I mean, I don't know that I would want that. I mean, just the insurance and finding labor. And I mean, that certainly we've heard some butchers, complain the right word of owning a butcher, a harvest facility. And, you know, it takes a lot of capital to get one of those started. And I think in Tennessee, maybe Kentucky, I know there's one of those mobile meat units, but we don't have one in Tennessee. But I mean, we are not shy of driving 8 hours one way to go to a butcher, because we used to just deal with two butchers before this, and now we're up to 8 butchers. It's been crazy. It has been crazy.
I think through this process, you hear some different farmers and ranchers say, well, maybe I should take things direct to the consumer then. And that may be a good idea, but what would you tell them from experience? Because I'm sure there are plenty of hurdles and challenges to be able to do that, but yet you have been very successful in it.
Well, right now, because and God bless America, you know, everyone is seeing that there's a need for local meat, local produce, local whatever. And so everyone that can finish an animal is starting to try, and they're wanting to grow their own direct-to-consumer business. And that's awesome, but you better slow down and get a butcher date. Whether you have animals yet or not, try to find a butcher date. And a lot of people have been messaging me saying they want to go with the retail cuts versus quarters, halves, or wholes. And that's another thing I recommend slowing down on, because there are USDA-inspected butchers available, but there are some custom butchers that are available, not necessarily tomorrow. You may still have to wait 2 or 3 months, but they're not a year to 2 years out on their schedule. And that is where you sell off the hoof, whether it's a pig, sheep, lamb, or pig, sheep, cows, or whatever. You sell that animal off the hoof in halves or wholes. And that's okay in the USDA's eyes. You don't have to get that done through a USDA-inspected facility. Because of that, that's maybe a recommendation that's what I would recommend. That's the route I would go until some of these USDA inspected butchers get opened back up. Because I'd hate for someone to you know, go to the sale barn or purchase a bunch of mama cows or some close to finished animals and then get these animals finished and then call the butcher to have USDA cuts made and they're 2 years out. Then what are you going to do with this finished animal? And so before you go buy anything, anyone getting into this business, check with the butchers in your surrounding area and get on their schedule. See how far their date's out. And then if you're going to go buy animals, maybe back up to the age that you need, to the weight that you need. If they're a year out, then maybe you only need a 500-pound calf instead of getting a 1,200-pound finished animal.
What do you see down the road then? Do you think that because we are going through this virus now, and that we will forever change the way that a lot of us purchase meat, or will we revert back to where we were, you know, 6 months ago someday, and people won't care as much maybe as they do right now about buying direct from somebody?
Well, I certainly hope the former is true. I mean, we haven't seen this push for local since local became local however many years ago, I mean, decades ago. And so, like I said before, I think people have, once you try it, once you taste it, you're never going to go back. We promised ourselves, my husband and I, when this started and the grocery stores were selling hamburger at $9-$10 a pound, we said, we're never going to raise our price through this. This is not the time to take advantage, because we were able to control the middleman on our end. And I know grocery stores didn't have that luxury. And so we didn't need to go up. And so I think we got a lot of customers that way who tried it thinking, oh gosh, you guys are a couple dollars cheaper than the grocery store. I'm going to buy a hamburger with you. And they've stayed, even though that hamburger has gone back down to $2 a pound at the grocery store, they have continued to stay. And I mean, I just got to rely on ourselves and our marketing and proving that our product is better than any product out there to continue to grow our customer base. I hope that people follow our stories on, you know, social media or whatever, and appreciate who we are and what we do. And that's just the path I got to keep pushing, even if some of the bandwagon jumpers fall off.
Let's wind up with that, because I want to make sure that people know how to find you, and then talk about how you are getting the word out and telling your story, because I'm sure that's a really important part of what you do.
Sure. And we have to take advantage, as any small business owner, let alone being an ag, of the free advertising or cheaper advertising that's out there. And that's through social media. I mean, I can't afford print publications. I can't afford to do an advertisement in even the local newspaper, but I can put some stuff out on social media. And so we're constantly building that Facebook and Instagram, and I'm constantly on there. I mean, I want people to see the day in the life of a family farm. And I also want them to know we're just not a family farm. We're a business. We're in the meat business. We sell meat. But I want them to know where their animals are coming from and to get that relationship with us. They may never even, if we start shipping, they may never even see our faces in person, but they love our family story and that we're authentic and that we can share the good, the bad, and the ugly of farming. And we want to open that up to the public. We have nothing to hide, and we say that all the time. You can come see us anytime you want. We have nothing to hide. And we want all of the United States and the world to know that agriculture is not that big, bad villain, that we're, so many of us are just small family farms wanting to feed our local community.
Great. Hey, Jenny, if people want to connect with you, is the easiest way Facebook, or how's the best way to connect with you?
For those that are on social media, at our farmers markets, I always say, so are you on Facebook or Instagram? And they're like, no, I'm just so jealous that they're not. Because it does take a lot of time out of a day. But for those that are on social media, we do Facebook and Instagram, and it's just Pilar Rock Farms, PILAROC, Pilar Rock Farms. And then we have a website that you can go to, and this little annoying thing will pop up. It says, would you like to get our newsletter? And you can sign up for that as well, and you can contact us on our website. And I hope your listeners do follow us. I mean, you will see, we are a funny little farm family, and we don't take ourselves very seriously. It's 90% fun and about 10% entertaining, because we do try to educate a lot on these weird cuts that we get back from our butcher on how to cook it and what recipes are out there and those kind of things. So we do try to educate on what it's like to be a meat producer.
Be sure to look up Pilar Rock Farms on the web. You'll enjoy learning more of their story. It's a very interesting look at something I've heard plenty of those in the livestock industry exploring as an option to getting more for the animals we raise. Remember, you can follow Farming the Countryside on Facebook, as well as our daily radio feature, American Countryside. We're posting more info, pictures, and stories on those sites for you throughout the week. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.